Cheryl Willis is a sixth-generation South Australian published author whose books have brought to life some aspects of the state's social history and the people behind organisations devoted to serving their country and serving their community. She has come in today to talk about her latest book launched recently, Miss Marriott's Circle, A Not-So-Distant Past. Cheryl, welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Fiona.
What prompted you to write this book?
Well, I wrote a book for the Pioneers Association of South Australia, and Mabel was the association's founder. And when I was researching Mabel's life, I was struck by this rippling circle of influence that she had and the work that she did for society, community work. And I realised that this book just had to be written, this story had to be written about Mabel. And as I continued the research, I met so many other amazing women, so the journey continued.
Well, let's look first of all at who was Mabel Marriott. She was, according to your book, the daughter of a clergyman, the fifth child of a family of nine, an accomplished pianist and one of the first women to do a degree course at Adelaide University.
Correct.
This was all in the late 1800s, so she really was a member of a pioneer family. Can you tell me something about these first families in South Australia?
The first families? Well, Mabel's grandfather was South Australia's first colonial chaplain, Charles Beaumont Howard, and he came out on the Buffalo, which was the ninth ship to arrive, with his young wife, Grace, and two children, and one of those little girls was Mabel's mother. Now, the early pioneers as such, so we're referring to the first European settlers, in about the first 10 years, laid the foundations of the province of what became the state of South Australia. They took risks to come here. Most of them were young and adventurous, but generally they brought their children here to have a better life. And this has continued to this day, that people come from all over the world for a better life. And it all started with those first pioneers.
They established schools for girls,
yes,
as well as St. Peter's College for,
yes,
boys, cottage homes, a destitute asylum, an orphanage, and Adelaide University.
Yes.
Of which Bishop Short, the first Protestant or Anglican, as we say today, Bishop of Adelaide, was Vice Chancellor. Now, those are truly Christian evangelicalism and voluntary service,
yes,
ethos, aren't,
yes,
they, aren't they? So it appears that Mabel's parents believed in education opportunities for girls, is that right?
I think so. I think that, as you rightly said, the foundations of South Australia were based very differently on those of the other states. It was based on voluntarism and idealism. There was very little government help, British government help, so funds needed to be raised. And they were raised through people with a philanthropic intent, I think, and there was a very strong religious faith. And based in that, I think that the philosophy of an equal opportunity was based, I think, on their faith and their push for equal opportunity in all spheres of life, including educational opportunity.
Were all Mabel's sisters, did they get the opportunity to go to university, and how many of them did?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure whether they were given the opportunity or not and didn't take it up. But Mabel was, I think all the girls were very musically inclined, mm-hmm, and Mabel did take that opportunity to do a year of education in the very first year that the Bachelor of Music was offered. So she was in that very first group that began that through Joshua Ives, Professor Ives, who was plucked out of English University to come over, and also he played the organ at the Adelaide Town Hall, and I think that helped supplement his income. The council helped supplement his income. But yes, she was amongst that first group, and about half of the group sat for their exams. I think there was about 16 that sat for the exams, and she was amongst the 14 who passed.
Was she awarded the Bachelor of Music? Because even Oxford and Cambridge didn't allow women to be called bachelors.
No, I think it was a three-year course and she completed the first year, second class. But I don't believe she actually continued. I can't find the evidence that she continued with the course. She did the first year.
So the reason for the title of your book becomes increasingly apparent as one reads on and discovers the many women, and some men, among whom and with whom Mabel Marriott worked. Many of them were privileged like herself, but one of the exciting aspects of the story is to see how increasingly hundreds and, as you go on, thousands of women in much less privileged positions joined the causes she represented and worked tirelessly for their aims and aspirations. Was she inspirational herself as a person?
I believe she had a strong sense of duty. She could certainly lead. She learnt practical skills. But I believe that she was brought up in a way that this is what you do and you think no more of it. And obviously, being in a religious family, very strong Christian faith, and following her father's example, that this was what she was brought up to do, and you didn't think any more of it. Inspirational. I don't know if that is the appropriate word for Mabel, because I don't think she was necessarily someone who was going to go out and inspire people. She did what she felt she had to do, so I'd say she led more by example.
Got you. Unlike the governor's wife, of course, she got stuck into meetings and really roused people up, didn't
she? Yes, she was quite an orator and an eloquent public speaker. So I see little evidence of Mabel standing up and speaking to lead and inspire. She was in the background quietly getting on with it.
Yes.
But clearly people looked up to her because as soon as she came back from England, for example, during the war, she was immediately brought into the committee of the League of Loyal Women by other women who had known her in their circles before she had gone away to see her sister.
Yes, she was what now in current parlance will be called a company worker, wasn't she, really?
I guess you could say that, yes. When I was looking through the minutes of the League of Loyal Women, I was struck by her taking on roles quite quickly. When some of the women, for example, went overseas with their husbands who were doctors, she took over the roles as acting secretary or taking the minutes, running meetings very, very quickly. So she was obviously very adept at
that. Now, what is the League of Loyal Women?
The League of Loyal Women was not so much an association in its own right, but it was formed to unite all women of all classes in the war work on the domestic front. It aimed to overcome any possible inefficiencies in the work that had to be done, and it aimed to give all women something to do. So there were hundreds of patriotic funds, as we know, at the time. And there were still apparently women who still needed to be brought in under the umbrella of this patriotism to give them something to do, particularly the women whose husbands, sons, brothers were away and they had no idea where they were, what they were doing, whether they were alive. And it must have been a frightening time. They were given practical work to do. And again, I repeat, reducing inefficiencies, I think, was paramount to the League of Loyal Women.
I was a little bit startled to read in your book that you were encouraged, or someone was encouraged, to join a rifle club when you joined.
Yes. I think, well, if your son or brother cannot go overseas for some reason, perhaps, you know, due to ill health, then he needs to join a rifle club because we might need to defend ourselves on the home front. So I think that was what that was all about. That's what I meant. They will find you something to do.
That's a very practical approach, I must say. So Mabel threw herself into the work of the League of Loyal Women when she returned to Adelaide in November 1915. But in 1915, and this is very sobering thought, Keswick Hospital was filling up with war wounded.
Yes.
So a recreational hut was built behind it.
Yes.
It just was spilling over and nowhere for them to go. And
yes.
Goodness.
I think South Australia wasn't well prepared, as perhaps the other states weren't either. Were we prepared for a world war? It was the first one. And the barracks were quickly taken over at Keswick. And the stables were even used for patients. Bearing in mind, I think they were very new stables and they had not been used for horses yet. So that was a good thing, I think. But yes, the photographs that you would see on the State Library's digital collection is amazing, the numbers that are out on verandas in beds. So they were certainly spilling out. And as you said, so early. And imagine what it was like in 1919 after the war and more men were coming back. So yes, it must have been an amazing time.
Well, one of the state's first Red Cross depots opened at the rear of the recreational hut in 1916.
Yes. The hut was built by the Catholic Women's League. And I believe the furniture was funded from the children's fund, the school children who were also given a job to do, raise funds. And there was also a small room that was for a quiet retreat for those who couldn't cope with the noise and the crowd. And the Emergency Services Committee of the League of Loyal Women went out in the voluntary capacity, of course, to give the men refreshments, and I think that started at about threepence, I think, a meal. And later on, as the cost of food went up, it went up a little bit, fourpence a meal. So they were feeding them. And yes, the depot was part of the building, it appears, but at the rear. And you can see a separate door going into this little depot. And it was one of the first Red Cross depots of its kind set up in South Australia.
And in 1917, Mabel was appointed honorary depot supervisor.
Yes.
And was there for 30 years?
Yes. It seems she did start in 1916. According to one source, the Bakewells started as taking on the role, but it seems that Mabel was there from the outset as well, as I can understand it. Sometimes the records, of course, from then, it's very difficult to get the facts 100% when she started working there. But she herself, in 1946, referred to the fact that she had been there for 30 years. And so she was certainly there from 1916, and by 1917, she was appointed honorary supervisor.
Honorary, yes.
Yes. Mm.
So what was the Cheer Up Society?
Well, the Cheer Up Society was established by Alexandrine Seeger, whose son, I believe, went to the war and increased his age to get in, the 17-year-old son, and he was killed in the war. She set up the Cheer Up Society to establish a place where the men could come back to when they were on leave, and it was more of a recreation facility, as I understand it.
Right. Tell us, what was the Trench Comforts Fund?
The Trench Comforts Fund began as a Trench Comforts Committee, one of the four committees that the League of Loyal Women initially established. And that was designed to provide trench comforts, as in just the basic little necessities, be that food or socks or handkerchiefs, for the men at the front. And that became the group of women who were involved in that became part of an Australia-wide comforts fund, and our Trench Comforts Fund was that South Australian arm of that fund. And again, I think it's part of, as the war progressed, having to centralise what needed to be done to supply these goods or comforts or whatever was required. And again, I go back to that word efficiencies, to keep everything running smoothly. And Lucy Ayres, by the way, was one of the women involved. And I'll mention her name now because she was the person who donated the records of the League of Loyal Women to the State Library. And her name is on there, and so I thought I'd mention that now. She was part of that group of women involved in the Trench Comforts Fund. Yes.
It's quite sobering to me when I was reading what comforts were sent over, that there was always large quantities of cigarettes.
Yes.
Which, of course, doesn't sit well with today.
Yes. And I think that, again, was probably handed around in the hospital as well.
Of course. One of the most practical and compassionate initiatives of Mabel's, that I thought anyway when I read your book, was that she set up trade workshops. Now, tell us about these.
The trade workshops, handicrafts. Mm. These were set up to give the men in the hospital something to do, and I guess it was an early form of occupational therapy. And they made baskets and bags. They ended up making shoes and boots and toys for the children. And when you think about it, it seems almost patronising in a way, but they took it on. And I'm thinking of it from my point of view, 100 years on. But back then, they took this on after fighting in trenches and going through so much that they could actually just quite happily sit. And again, it was giving them something to do and giving them a little bit of socialisation as well with the other men.
Yes, that's true.
Yes.
Take their mind off their, I suppose, pain. And
yes, bringing them together. Mm. And they also learnt to type. There was a typing pool as well, so giving them things to do. But again, it went further than that. When they were able to leave and go home, if they could not go back to work as they knew it, at least they had something to do and they could sell those goods as well out in the shops.
They had learned another skill.
Yes.
Learned a trade skill.
Yes.
There was an enormous amount of trade skill learning in the TB hostel as well. I think it was opened by Ella Cleggett, wasn't it?
Oh, at Angerichner.
That's right.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Ella Cleggett, I think her brother had a friend who had gone camping up in the Flinders Ranges. He had TB and he came back feeling recuperated from his stay, and that inspired Ella to establish the Angerichner Hostel where men with TB could stay and recuperate. And the land was donated for this use to establish the hotel, the hostel, and the Red Cross were involved in funding that as well. There was a soldier had been a carpenter and he taught the men how to build goods, furniture with, I believe it was old tracks and red gum and railway.
Red gum sleepers. Yes.
Sleepers. Yes, that was. Thank you for reminding me that one.
Surplus sleepers. That fascinated me.
Yes.
So, really, sadly, when World War II began, the women of the state were much better prepared to support the medical staff at the front.
Yes.
How did they bring this about?
This is the evolution of the practical skills and the unfortunate circumstances, of course, of the First World War. But again, picking up the skills and they developing. I see, for example, the Red Cross Emergency Services Division grown out of the Emergency Services Committee of the League of Loyal Women. Perhaps different people involved, but again, there was, you know, that embryo from the First World War. And if I may mention one of my heroines, Kathleen Kiffin Thomas. Again, we go right back to the pioneers because her great-grandparents were one of the first settlers to come out. Her great-grandfather bought the printing press that established the first newspaper. And Kathleen went to work during the First World War for Lady Galway in the Red Cross rooms at Government House. And she remained with the Red Cross all those years and became divisional commandant in South Australia. And she travelled around the state recruiting women for the Red Cross Emergency Services Division. I feel that that is elemental to the women of South Australia being prepared for the Second World War. And another thing with World War II, they knew it was coming for years, whereas they weren't initially so prepared for the First World War. But this time they were ready. And the work that they did, it's just mind-blowing, really, that so much could be achieved in such a short time to have the women of South Australia ready in first aid training and mechanical training. And it's all to meet Kathleen Kiffin-Thomas and the work of the Red Cross.
Yes, you've covered that so beautifully in your book, you really have. And it's quite sobering to think that there was such a huge drive by the women to really do something.
Yes.
They couldn't perhaps go out and fight, but they could do something.
Yes,
and that,
yes.
That was great. Amongst all of this, one of the little niggles in my mind was, out of 9 children, of which Mabel was the 5th, only one of her sisters married. Have
yes.
you got any thoughts on that?
I haven't got the answer to that one. I have no idea. I think that perhaps for the girls, and perhaps Mabel, she saw herself for a higher calling than being a mother and a homemaker, particularly in those times. I did consider that there may have also been perhaps health reasons. Isabel, her younger sister Isabel, for example, was a diabetic. And her nephew, Gracie's son, Sydney, was also a diabetic. And I know that there were one or two forebears that I know of that were also diabetic. And there seems to be perhaps some chest issues and illnesses, which perhaps is just part of the times. I mean, they didn't have antibiotics then, of course, either. But I do wonder if the reasons may be more complex than we know, that only the one married. And, of course, she was packed off to England to marry a vicar.
That's right, she was too. Now, despite the huge amount of research that's obviously gone into producing this book, your writing style is not academic but is narrative and is perfect for telling the stories of all these astonishing characters that populate its pages. You give them voice and you bring them to life.
Thank you.
Now, was this your intention? To bring the characters up front and let them speak for themselves.
Yes, it was. And I think if I return back to just briefly to my first book for the Pioneers Association, their second president, George Cummins Morfitt, was instrumental in bringing the stories of the early pioneers into early forms of publication. Because the early members of the Pioneers Association were the grandchildren and still maintained their records and diaries. And Morfitt was such a passionate believer in preserving the history of this state. And when you read some of these wonderful stories of which I have drawn on early on, it did, I believe, inspire me because these are the real people and the real events that took place. And just like us, they had their problems, they had their arguments, they had their joys and sorrows. And I wanted to bring their voices back because when I was reading some of these stories, I couldn't, it wasn't for me to tell their story, it was for them to tell their story.
I do very much like the way that you have included many letters and speeches and newspaper articles where appropriate. They immerse the reader in the language and atmosphere of the times. Could I ask you just to read us an extract from one of these, please?
Would you like me to read a piece that was, again, by somebody else? It was an article written in the press just after Anzac Day in 1923. And I think with this year being the centenary of Anzac, I'd like to read a passage from the book, which is an extract from an article appearing in the press soon after Anzac Day in 1923. The article was titled, "After Many Days, Life at Keswick Hospital, Where Service is a Pleasure." By this time, Mabel had been working at the hospital for 7 years. She stayed on at the hospital a further 23 years. There are a few men who have been in the hospital continuously for the past 3 years, but the great majority return at ever recurring intervals, while others again are receiving attention for the first time since discharge from the war. Surgical cases are still prevalent, and many of them look very sick men, except, perhaps, for their cheeriness. In the wards, on the verandas, and out in the courtyards are men shattered and ill, but undaunted. One of the most remarkable features of the Keswick Hospital is the quiet, unobtrusive work which has been carried on by voluntary helpers throughout the past 7 years. Yet the word work is misapplied. It is a pleasure, a part of their lives, to the women who have given their services year after year to the soldiers at Keswick. One wonders what the men would do without the Red Cross representative, Miss Mabel Marriott, who has been in attendance there every day for the past 7 years. Her headquarters are at the Red Cross depot attached to the hall, and here she has a library and a store. Motor rides are also arranged twice a week by the Red Cross representative, and the men visit favourite spots in the hills or are guests at the homes of men and women who have not forgotten the days of war. The representative also arranges that a string orchestra visits once a fortnight. It takes a woman of exceptional tact to visit an institution every day for 7 years, to be intimately concerned with the life of the institution, and to still retain happy relationships with all departments. Sitting in the little depot, surrounded by Bovril, tins of biscuits, shaving brushes, and articles of clothing, all neatly arranged, and shelves of books, there came to us from the recreation hall the sound of a piano, and then a man's voice singing. I remembered that back in one of the wards a man with a broken leg had stood up as we passed, and that I was ashamed. I came away wondering at the calm patience of such men. As the tram passed down the road, there came again across the grass a snatch of song. It is still with me.
And I'm right there too. I can feel it and see it. That's a great extract. Thank you very much. Cheryl, who do you think will read this book?
I think in the first instance the people who will read this book are those who are already lovers of South Australian history, perhaps interested in women's history and military history. Who I'm hoping will read this book will be the people who don't normally read South Australian history or have never thought they would have an interest in South Australian history. I'd like them to pick it up and be inspired and spread the word of our amazing history and heritage and the amazing women who have come before us.
Is that what you set out to do, or has this really come to you as you've been writing the book?
I think that a little bit of both, and perhaps more so, as I continue to write the book, because some of the women that I met and some of the passages that I found in the stories, I knew that they had to be written, and I was inspired myself and drawn to tears many times myself, and I still am. And it was a story that had to be written. I always felt that Mabel was there with me the whole way.
You have told it beautifully in that lovely, soft narrative style you have, which is really, really lovely. So people who get this book or who are interested in a copy, go into the Wakefield Press website?
Yes, they can go into Wakefield Press themselves in Rose Street in Theberton, or they can log on to the website and they'll find some amazing history books there, and hopefully mine first.
Oh, Cheryl, I do thank you so much for investing in us so beautifully your time today. And
thank you,
I appreciate you coming in, and I wish you all the best with this book. If for what it's worth, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you, Fiona. I appreciate being here.
Fiona White was talking there to Cheryl Willis about her latest book, Miss Marriott's Circle, A Not-So-Distant Past. The minutiae of social history is wrapped up in so many fascinating stories that bring life to that embryonic era and the characters who founded South Australia.